You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a professor who's been leading a research team at the UW that studies how plants grow in space. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Governor Walker has called for a special session of the state legislature to take up his proposed welfare changes. A new project explores stories of addiction in Wisconsin, and a former Milwaukeean hits a hot streak on Jeopardy. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
Well, the big story late this week, Governor Walker yesterday calling for a special session of the legislature. He wants changes in welfare programs in Wisconsin. Can you talk about some of the changes that he's looking at?
Sure. Well, there are a number of proposals that he has laid out, including changes to food stamp requirements and drug screening for people who receive subsidized housing. We can talk about some of these, but probably the most notable or most high profile proposal is to have a system to require able-bodied working age Medicaid beneficiaries to get different skills training and education and do job search activities and other requirements in order to have people be able to qualify for Medicaid.
Here's a listen to Governor Walker explaining the goal of these proposals. This was in a video released yesterday.
You see, for those who are able, we want to enable them to get a job and ultimately a career to support themselves and their families. You see, I believe that public assistance should be more like a trampoline and not a hammock. These reforms will help move Wisconsin forward.
So Governor Walker also pointing out we've got low unemployment in the state. It's a good time to move people into the workforce. People who are currently receiving public assistance. Has that been from the governor and from Republicans in the legislature the main selling point here?
This has been this basic suite of policies has been something that that Walker has believed in and pushed for many years, including when the state's economy was not in the shape that it's in now. So I don't know about that, but it is true that that there are more people working today and that it is relatively easier to find a job. You know, you can sort of hear it in that clip, the sort of essence of the conflict here, right? There, Walker and other advocates for this, they present it as a way of helping people to get the skills they need or to kick addictions or make other life changes in order to better themselves, have better lives. But also then in the same breath, he says public assistance should be a trampoline, not a hammock, which sort of it furthers this idea of there's sort of like deserving versus undeserving poor people. And the critical view is that these policies will have the effect of kicking people off public assistance who might need it.
Yeah, and talk more about the Democratic response to this call for a special session and the bills included in it.
Well, so it's that exactly, right? It's that this creates obstacles for people who are poor and who depend upon programs. I mean, I do think Medicaid, which in Wisconsin we call it Badger Care, but it's Medicaid, is a big part of this discussion. So Medicaid has never been understood as like a quote unquote welfare program that you would need to demonstrate to worthiness for. There are about 1.2 million people on Medicaid in Wisconsin, and the majority of them, the households receiving Medicaid, do have someone who works. It's true in Wisconsin. It's true everywhere. They might be working at a job that doesn't pay very much, or it could be like a family where one spouse works and another one is caring for children or disabled family members or elderly. You know, people's lives are complicated. But so one estimate is that these type of requirements would only apply to a little bit more than 10% of everyone who receives Medicaid in Wisconsin, about 148,000 people. But it sort of creates this perception that you have to prove that you're worthy in order to like get sort of basic health access, which is, you know, Democrats are very critical of that idea.
For a lot of these changes, they include things like Medicaid and food assistance, which is ultimately coming in many cases from the federal government. So the state would need waivers from the federal government to do that. But As we've heard from the Trump administration a week ago, they're opening the door to more of these kind of waivers, it sounds like.
Right. Yes. Exactly. So the Trump administration is open to waivers on Medicaid. Wisconsin is one of nine states that has sort of jumped at the chance for that. Important to say, there will be legal challenges about this. Kentucky is going down a similar path. They're already are gearing up for legal challenges that would tie that up. Whether it actually is legal for a state to put those sorts of requirements on Medicaid recipients will have to be determined in court.
And we'll keep covering this special session. The morning show on Monday, we'll be talking about this after 7. Again, that's coming up Monday morning on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the big stories in Wisconsin this week. And Rob, let's take a look at a project that you oversaw at USA Today Network Wisconsin. Your reporters there talked to 10 people in different areas of the state recovering from heroin addiction. What led you to pursue this angle specifically?
Sure. So we wanted to do something on the people, on the individuals who are, dealing with heroin addictions, and in particular who are in recovery. And I should say I was one of the project editors. I work with my colleague Mark Trinan, who is the leader of another team here, and there I think about a dozen people all told worked on this project, a number of reporters and so on. I believe it. The first genesis of it was with a reporter named Chris Miller, who wanted to speak to people who had experienced addiction about how they became addicted. Like, how does one fall into an opiate addiction? And it was from that germ of an idea that we created what turned out to be a much larger project, and one that I hope it shows the scope and the real human experience Yeah,
and there are a lot of common themes, but one thing I took from looking at these stories is you can look at the statistics, but the stories are all different for different people.
Right. Well, yeah, and this is just the thing, right? Anybody who's paying attention at all knows that opiate addiction is a real and widespread problem. The numbers on it can cause one's head to spin. And so once you start looking at the people as people, there are patterns. I mean, it is a common story. People who began their path toward an addiction by being prescribed pills, or getting their hands on some pills, and they eventually, because they became addicted, switching over to heroin because it was cheaper. So there are patterns that emerge, but it is true at the same time. Each story has its own textures and its own reality.
And all 10 people in this case working on recovery, I don't know that they'll ever feel fully recovered, but at least some hope that for people out there suffering with this kind of addiction now, there is a chance to change things down the road.
Yeah, that's right. And we hope to... the nature of the project, the individual profiles are relatively short. The visuals are extraordinary. There's audio from the interviews that really gives you a sense of the person. So what we hope to do is sort of continue to follow some of these stories. There are some people who are facing, potential prison time for crimes they've committed. There are some people who are a little bit farther along in their recovery, and there are some who are quite new. And so our hope is that we can continue to expand the stories and follow what happens to these people and hopefully track their recovery as well.
And Rob, ending on a lighter note, a quick look at a big Jeopardy run for someone from Wisconsin.
Yeah, this guy, so I didn't see it, but it sounds like this guy did Wisconsin proud. Gilbert Collins is a Milwaukee native. He's an administrator at Princeton University, and he won $84,201 in 5 days on Jeopardy, which is a pretty good run.
Gilbert, a graduate of the Rufus King High School in Milwaukee. Rob, we'll keep an eye out for more Wisconsin success stories around the country. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Rob Metzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He got us up to speed on some of the latest state news. Since the 1960s, scientists at the UW have been involved with studying how plants would grow in space. After all, if we're thinking about traveling big distances through space, maybe to a place like Mars, we're going to probably need to grow some of our own food. Simon Gilroy is here in the studio. He's a professor of botany at the UW-Madison. He's been leading a research team at the UW to study the effects of growing plants in a zero-gravity environment. Simon, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Well, good to be here, Rob.
Well, can you tell us some of the history of UW's involvement in space botany?
It's crazy to think that we have been a center for growing plants and working out how to grow plants in space basically since the space program began. So there's been some very successful programs working with things like potatoes and stuff like that. One of the flagships has been Fast Plants, which is a program to get very rapidly cycling plants that you can do experiments with very quickly. And the really cool thing about that is not only is that for experiments for researchers and labs, but those plants are distributed to everyone. So you can do your own experiments, sort of mimicking and trying to work out what's going on in that weird, weird environment that we work in space.
Now, I'm a poor gardener. I have trouble growing plants here on Earth. I understand zero gravity in particular makes some really unique challenges for things we take for granted, like water and oxygen.
Yeah, yep. So there's a lot of stuff that we just take for granted because gravity is everywhere all the time. So imagine that you're on Earth and you want to water a plant in a pot. You take your watering can, you tip it on its side, the water comes out.
Thanks, hey, gravity.
Thanks, gravity, yeah. And so in space, none of that works. And so it becomes very complicated to think, how on earth am I going to water my plant? I can't use a watering can. So you have to start doing things like injecting liquid into soil, but then soil doesn't really work, and so you have to manipulate the soil. Things like the shape of a flame is, you don't think about this, but is actually shaped by gravity. When you light a candle, the shape of the flame that comes out of that long tapering shape, that's driven by gravity moving air around, and that convection mixes up air all the time. That doesn't occur in space. So you get all these dead zones where big gas gradients build up, and things that biology just naturally works with on Earth just stop working.
And reading about your work, and this is a big part of, I understand what you're working on now, if I have this right, water clumps differently. It can actually work in a way that it blocks the gases plants need from getting in.
Yeah. So again, this the crazy world of no gravity. So if you imagine you have water on Earth and you take your watering can and pour it onto the soil, the water is going to percolate down through the soil. That's totally driven by gravity. So you take that away. What drives the movement of water? And water, think of your pictures in your mind of what water does on Earth. They're all streams flowing and oceans moving backwards and forwards and waterfalls. That's all driven by gravity. So those forces that move water, they're not there in space. So water becomes super sticky. So its movements are driven by things like capillary forces and surface tension, like the molecular components of what make water move on Earth. Uh-huh. If you remove gravity, they become really important. So we've probably all seen those movies in the astronauts where they have a ball of water floating in space, and it's held together by the water sticking to itself because gravity isn't pulling it down and pulling it apart. So imagine now that you have this sticky water and you water a plant. It sticks to the surface of the plant. And then you have a barrier. That is what happens next to the Mississippi in the spring when a farmer has planted his field, the corn is coming up, the seedlings are there, and then it floods. And the reason that corn's going to die is because it doesn't have access to oxygen, and the roots will suffocate just like a human would suffocate underwater.
Now, talk about the experiments you're doing to try to figure out, okay, how do we overcome this water barrier?
So we've been really, really fortunate. We've had the possibility to put a couple of experiments up onto the space station. In fact, our last one splashed down on January the 13th. So we've just got those samples coming in. So that is super exciting for everyone in the lab. And so we know what we think the problem is, which is that the water has become sticky and it's making this barrier. But that's kind of a natural thing that occurs on Earth during flooding. And so plants, they don't die instantaneously when you if you overwater your pot plant, it doesn't die within 2 minutes, because plants have got a capacity to kind of deal with it. Eventually, they're going to croak, but they're going to keep going. And what they do is they sort of reprogram themselves to be able to just, can I just get past this period of time when I'm flooded, and then I'll grow on and be fine. So they have machinery, the molecular machinery inside them, to be able to deal with that. So what we do in the lab is we look at what that molecular machinery might be, and then we tweak it, tinker it with it, to try and make plants that on Earth resist flooding a little bit better. So that has some applications to like farming and stuff like that. But one of the big goals then is if flooding in space is a big deal, those plants should grow better in space. And so those engineered plants are the ones we put into space to see what happens.
Simon Gilroy is with us. He's professor of botany at UW-Madison, and he works on trying to get plants grow in space on the International Space Station. So you're sending up seeds with the astronauts. What kind of plant are we talking about here?
So we use, it's like the lab rat of plant biology. It's a plant called Arabidopsis. It's a weedy little plant, and it was chosen a good few years, maybe 20 years ago, by plant biologists with the idea that if a lot of people work on the same plant, and we really understand this plant fantastically well, that knowledge could be moved on to other plants. So this little weedy plant, Arabidopsis, was the model because it grows super fast. It's really small, which for spaceflight becomes a really big deal. And it was one of the first organisms where all of the DNA within the organism was sequenced. So we know every gene which is inside it. So, and that's a huge tool set to work with to do all of this engineering.
And I understand you've worked with astronauts to train them on, I mean, because if I'm trained to be an astronaut, which I'm not, I'm probably not also a botanist or even maybe an expert space gardener. You've done training with them.
Yep. So we get to go down to Johnson Space Center, and we get to sit down with the astronauts and go through what we think are the technical, like fiddly little bits of our protocols. Those guys are absolutely like remarkable, not just because they're quite prepared to sit on top of like the biggest rocket that you've ever seen, but they are really able to pick up ideas and remember things, because you can imagine we're not the only experiment which is up there. Mm-hmm. We get to train the astronauts. The astronaut who did our experiment, Scott Tingle, absolutely remarkable guy. But super nice as well. So just like a normal guy, he turns out to be an astronaut. And he does hundreds of experiments and kind of remembers them all. I can't remember where my keys are. And yet we train him 6 months ahead of time and he remembers everything. It's just unbelievable.
So you said the package was up there. You sent seeds up, I guess. And now plants have come back down. Are you still waiting to get your hands on this batch?
Yep. So what happens is one of the researchers in the lab will fly down to Kennedy Space Center. We'll check everything out and make certain that those samples are good. Well, we kind of know they are because we get video back down from the space stations. They're growing. So we'll get those samples. Then those are kind of precious. We don't want to lose them. So they will be sent up here in a thing called a custom critical truck. So they'll come up, and then probably in about maybe a week or two's time, we'll have the samples. And then we spend a year and a half trying to tease apart molecularly what happened in them.
And this has got to be like Christmas and birthday and New Year's Day all rolled into one for you when you get that supply.
Absolutely. The way to think about it is this is the culmination of 3.5 years worth of planning and work to get one experiment. And as a researcher in a lab normally, you kind of know you get a do-over. Like if something goes wrong, you can always do the experiment again. But we never get to do these experiments again. So this is sort of high-stakes stuff, and we get them back. And, it's pretty awesome.
So you take this weedy little plant, and hopefully you get this batch, and you learn things about what works for growing stuff, growing plants in zero gravity. Do you start to be able then to apply that to stuff we're going to want to eat?
Yep. So the long-term goal is a practical one, which is space is a very, very strange place to put biology. Mm-hmm. Like biology exists on the surface of the planet, of 1G, the Earth, all the things we know that the Earth is good at doing. So plants haven't adapted to that environment. And so we've had 10,000 years of agriculture, and we've had 50 years of growing things in space. So we're trying to really, really speed up that whole process take that knowledge and then turn it into practical application for spaceflight.
Do you have suspects in mind of plants we might be familiar with that you think, okay, this might be a good candidate when we're trying to get some foodstuffs in orbit?
Oh, absolutely. So we interact a lot with the as you might expect, with the people who are doing the food production for astronauts. Lettuce, spinach, radishes. If you can think of a plant that you would grow as a gardener and it grows quickly and you eat most of the plant, so you don't throw away a lot of the plant, then those are the target crops which we're going for.
And there have been some, I think, greens experience, lettuce experiments in space, right?
Oh, yep. There's a thing called the veggie, which you grow is big enough to grow proper plants, you know, plants big enough to eat. The astronauts grew lettuce to the size that they could harvest it. Half of it went to science and half of it they ate, and it looked like they were drinking champagne. They were holding it up like because fresh food in space is a big, big deal.
Now, you're working on this here on Earth. Would you ever, given the opportunity, want to be up there working on your plans?
Oh, yeah, like in a second. Oh, yeah. Are you crazy? Of course. But we know enough about it. We wouldn't want to stay there. Space is a hard place for biology, and this is the challenge for NASA, that human biology is the biology of the surface of the Earth with 1G, and all of these studies are trying to work out how to keep people healthy for a long period in space, because space is a hard place to live in. So a few days.
So you've got this package coming. You're going to be doing lots of experiments. What are the next steps after you get a hold of this?
So we will extract the DNA from these plants and use a technique which lets us to measure the level of every single gene which is in that plant. So you imagine some of them have gone up in space, some of them have gone down in space, and we have exactly identical plants that we grew on the Earth. And we're going to do a pattern matching. We'll look for patterns of genes going up, patterns of genes going down. We're talking about 30,000 genes per plant. So
wow.
This is a big pattern that we're going to start playing with.
Sounds great. Simon, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
No, it's been great fun.
That's Simon Gilroy, professor of botany at UW-Madison. We've been talking about his research going on at UW on growing plants in space. One of the biggest automotive events of the year is taking place in the Motor City. The North American International Auto Show, better known as the Detroit Auto Show, is wrapping up its first week. We're getting a solid glimpse into what automakers have in store for the coming year. And if you're in the market for a new pickup, you might be in luck. Trucks seem to be the big winner at this year's show, but there's been a little something for everyone, and there's a lot of high technology on the way, too, in the auto market. Todd Lassa is the Detroit Bureau Chief for Automobile Magazine. Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good evening, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, before we get into what's going on there, can you paint a picture of what goes on in an auto show for people who haven't been to one of these major ones? What's the scene like?
This week it starts out with the press days, which in this case was Sunday and Monday, and a little bit of Tuesday, and then there are industry days. This is in the case of the Detroit Auto Show for the week leading up to the public days. Basically, it's a way for automakers to show off their new products. These are cars and trucks that I haven't had a chance to drive yet because they're brand new. They're showing off the new models on the show floor. Traditionally, it's also a time to show some concept cars and show direction where automakers are intending to go with future product. Concept cars have started to lose a little steam, if you will, lately, although there were three important concepts at this show, all done by the Japanese automakers.
Well, let's get into some general trends. What are you seeing as you look at what's out there at the auto show?
There's always, for years, there have been this move toward more autonomy, more connectivity in cars. That's something that's kind of ongoing. Of course, there's a lot of talk about electrification. That's not quite the same as going full battery electric, but adding mild hybrid or regular hybrid systems, we're seeing that even in pickup trucks. The Ram 1500 pickup truck launches in a little while, in a few months, with a what they call 48-volt system, a 48-volt electrical system that kind of aids the gasoline engine with extra power and also a better fuel economy because better stop-start systems. Stop-start, if you're not familiar with them, are the systems that shut the engine down when you come to a stoplight and keep, you know, the air conditioning and the or the heating, the heater this time of year, and the radio and everything else going, and then starts up automatically as soon as you put your foot on the throttle. So we're seeing more of that. And this year is the year of the truck, but that has a lot to do with product cadence, the fact that that General Motors and Fiat Chrysler have been working on new trucks, which are still a huge important part of the market, for several years. And so there are new full-size trucks from Chevrolet at this show, and the new full-size Ram, which is part of Fiat Chrysler, at this show. Ford, in addition, is showing its latest, it's bringing back its so-called mid-size truck, which is the Ford Ranger.
Yeah, and it seems like, reading your publications, some other companies have maybe dropped out of that mid-size pickup market. Is that right?
Well, actually, Ford had dropped out for about 5 or 6 years. I think it's been about that long. General Motors dropped out just briefly for about 2 years and then came back with the Chevrolet Colorado and the GMC Canyon. The Ford Ranger, it looked like Ford was going to drop out permanently. Those trucks, the last Ford Ranger that Ford offered was a very aged product back in the early 2010s, and it really didn't give you much of a fuel economy advantage over a full-size F-150, nor did it give much of a price advantage, although now people are buying more and more expensive pickup trucks in that full-size category, so this can kind of slot below that. So when Chevy and GMC brought back their mid-size trucks, Ford looked at it, and Ford wants to be the pickup truck leader, and so it had to bring that back and compete. Those are more of lifestyle trucks. You generally won't see work crews using those smaller pickup trucks, even though a small pickup truck, what you consider small pickup now, those mid-sized trucks are about the same size as a full-size pickup truck from 3 or 4 generations ago. And then you have Fiat Chrysler, Sergio Marchionne, the CEO, said that he doesn't see any reason to bring back the Dodge Dakota, which was the competitor in that category. But there's not a reason to bring back the Dodge Dakota, because instead we'll soon have a Jeep Wrangler pickup truck, probably called the Scrambler, and that would serve that kind of lifestyle vehicle need in the pickup truck market.
Talking to Todd Lassa, Detroit Bureau Chief for Automobile Magazine, looking at the big auto show going on now in Detroit. Covered trucks some there. Todd, what are you seeing when it comes to cars?
Well, what I'm seeing when it comes to cars is kind of a move from cars to sport utility vehicles. There's still a lot of interest in cars, but last year there were about 17.15 or 17.2 million cars and trucks sold in the United States. And of those, about two-thirds were either pickup trucks, regular other sorts of trucks, or sport utility vehicles. And for example, one of the standout concepts was the Lexus LF1 Limited. Limitless. It's hard to keep these names straight sometimes.
Sure.
And the Lexus is a it's a concept, but it's a kind of a tall, something between a tall station wagon and a sport utility vehicle, only with much better proportions than sports utility vehicles currently on the market, that I feel, and there's some indication, could be replacement for the Lexus GS sedan, so that Lexus, along with some of the other luxury manufacturers, will probably be paring down their sedan selection in the future and just adding more sport utility vehicles or crossover vehicles to their lineups, and this would kind of replace the mid-size sedan, and Lexus would continue to do the smaller IS and larger LS. It's a very good-looking car, though, and again, largely because of those proportions, and because, at least in my mind, it doesn't look that much like at least the traditional sport utility vehicle. It's much less clunky looking than that.
And Todd, you mentioned autonomy earlier, meaning people talk about self-driving cars. I understand there are different levels and gradations of how autonomous a car is. Where are we on self-driving cars right now?
Well, we've had some of the systems slowly come on over the last 10, 12, 15 years. Adaptive cruise control is one kind of stepping stone toward that, the type of cruise control that will change its speed if another car cuts in front of you or if you catch up with a car in your lane on the freeway. You have some controls, assist in keeping in your lane. You have radars, you have cameras being added to cars, and we're currently at about a level two, between a level two and level three with the new Cadillac Supercruise system, which will stay in its lane on a highway, on a limited access highway, and steer for you while you're sitting behind the wheel. You have to remain attentive, though, and there's actually a system within that car that a sensor that can tell if you're not paying attention to the road, and then it will tell you you have to take over driving again. So this is we're still in the early stages, but things are progressing pretty quickly, maybe even more quickly than we thought. For example, GM, which of course does the Cadillac Supercruise, makes the Cadillac Supercruise on the Friday before the auto show. And the day after the CES wrapped up in Las Vegas, the Consumer Electronics Show announced that it would be mass producing a level four, level five driverless car by next year. And this is a car without any steering wheel, without pedals, without any kind of controls. Level four would be more likely for it, which means it would be geofenced. It would only work in areas where the roads are controlled and limited to pedestrians and bicyclists, for example.
We're talking right now about the top automotive trends for 2018. Our guest is Todd Lassa, Detroit Bureau Chief for Automobile Magazine. He's giving us the highlights from the Detroit Auto Show going on now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you car or truck shopping in 2018? If so, what is important to you in a new vehicle, and what features can you live without? If you've been following the show, what are you excited about, and would you drive a driverless car? Kind of a paradox there. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Todd Lassa from Automobile Magazine. He's with us to talk about the big reveals and hot trends at this year's Detroit Auto Show and what it all means for drivers and consumers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the latest car technology, the new releases, what's on the market? What are you looking for if you're looking for a car right now? And what do you think of the idea of driverless cars, more electric cars on the market, or at least electric options? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Todd, you talked about more connectivity, high-tech connections for cars. What are we seeing this year at the show?
Well, we're seeing a proliferation of Apple CarPlay and Android for auto, and more 4G LTE systems with Wi-Fi hotspots right inside your car. Of course, the other element of this is that the automakers want to connect cars to each other so that they talk with each other, and that's part of the road to autonomy. To make it safe, if your car is self-driving and knows where the other cars are, you'll have much less chance of any kind of accident, any kind of collision. But of course, you also have the issue of, well, who controls the data? Who owns the data? But the cars are just, more and more entertainment information systems inside the car, and being able to listen to Spotify or use the car to talk hands-free on your phone, that sort of thing.
Sounds like potential for a lot more distraction. Is that a safety concern? Maybe we better have driverless cars if we have all this internet access in the car.
Well, you hit the nail on the head, Rob. It's that, you know, all these distractions, all these potential distractions go hand in hand with driverless cars. You know, it's kind of which comes first. And if you have, you know, even that Cadillac Supercruise system that's already available, and then there are other levels a little bit below the Cadillac system from some of the competitors, Nissan, for example, where you really don't, you can get by without paying attention quite so much. That's not what they're meant for. You're supposed to be watching the road, but in the end, once these cars are capable of self-driving, you'll be able to pay attention to those distractions instead of pay attention to the road eventually. That'll be the case.
Let's bring on a caller now. Eric is with us in Milwaukee. Eric, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, basically, I wanted to mention, you know, this is probably 10 years down the road, but I wanted to mention this idea of time, how much more time we would have in our lives if we're not actually driving. Say, you know, you're planning for a meeting, or say you're out with some friends and you can have a drink in the car on the way to wherever you're going. All these things that are going to make our lives so much faster. Which, I mean, a good thing or not, it's going to happen. And I think that there's going to be a just kind of change in the way we live our lives. And I think that's something we should reflect on.
Eric, thanks for the call. So, Todd, your thoughts on more time in our lives, time well spent in traffic?
Well, I think Eric's got it right. The question is, how are we going to be spending that time? Downside, as far as I'm concerned, is that GM's already, it's working on a system within its Sirius XM and connectivity technology to be able to sell you more stuff in the car. In other words, the car is driving itself. Would you like to stop for a coffee at, you know, Brand X Coffee down the block here? Do you need to go here? You know, may we suggest restaurants or whatever. Then on the other hand, you know, if the car is driving itself to work, and you know, the automakers make a point that you know, you might still want to be able to drive a car if you're an enthusiast like me, where you like to drive, but you don't want to be doing that in stop and go traffic on the way to work. Well, what are you going to be doing instead? You're going to be working on the way to work. So we're going to be putting in more work hours. You know, that's probably going to be the case.
Eric, thanks for that call. I want to just pass along a quick question from James in Milwaukee. We're a little short on time, but James is looking for a car. Price is an issue. Are there option-free, maybe lower-budget cars on the horizon, Todd?
Well, there are always low-priced cars available if you're talking about a brand-new car, and car prices are going up. But even with the with all this technology coming on board, if you're willing to do without some of the latest technology, there are some pretty good cars in the $20,000 to $25,000 area, and cars like the Honda Civic, one of the best in class. You can go down to say $15,000 to $20,000. This is MSRP, and go to a smaller car like a Honda Fit, or I hate to keep mentioning Honda. There are other brands that are very good in this area that have some decent cars. You know, Subaru. Impreza, Mazda 3, that give you a decent amount of features, decent amount of space, and even though they're smaller cars, the crash structures and the safety features are so good that they are quite good. You don't have to worry about driving a smaller car among all the trucks that are on the road these days.
Todd, thanks a lot for joining us. Enjoy the rest of the auto show.
Rob, happy to do it.
That's Todd Lassa. He's the Detroit Bureau Chief for Automobile Magazine. He joined us to talk about some of the highlights and trends at this year's Detroit Auto Show and give us a glimpse into what we could be driving in the nearish future. Wisconsin researchers are joining a worldwide effort to discover new antibiotics through crowdsourcing. As Shemaine Mills reports, it's medical problem solving on a really large scale.
A dwindling supply of new antibiotics is a health threat that scientists around the world are trying to solve. They need as much help as possible, but there's a shortage of science graduates in the U.S. Joe Handelsman wants to change that by teaching every college freshman the basics of research.
If we could get every freshman in college into research courses and teach them the excitement of discovery and what science really is, the inquiry process, and hook them on it, we would have a chance at, one, keeping more students in science, and even better, we could have a scientifically literate society.
Handelsman directs the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. That's where college instructors from around the state recently took a week-long crash course as part of what's called the Small World Initiative. It's the brainchild of Handelsman and presented on this day by University of Connecticut biology professor Nicole Broderick.
We're really looking forward to having you here for the week, so we're going to start things off with a bit of an introduction. So I'm going to tell a bit about the background for Small World and what we're going to be doing this week.
As part of the Small World Initiative, instructors like UW Green Bay associate biology professor Brian Merkel learn how to teach their students how to find new antibiotics to replace those that no longer work.
Once I heard about it, I just couldn't believe that something like this has existed. So for me, just personally, professionally, I'm going to learn some new things, which I am very excited about, very passionate about. But I think what it can do for our students and how it can address this problem, do all of that at the same time, it's an incredible opportunity.
Merkel and other participants spent part of the week in the lab. Most of the widely used antibiotics have come out of the dirt, and that's where the Small World Initiative is looking for the next generation of drugs. In a UW-Madison lab, student teachers put on white coats and assemble their equipment while their instructor guides them.
Those of you who came from the state, you were charged with perhaps bringing your own soil sample. I think I saw some baggies. And so those of you who didn't, we have some soil samples for you. So you also can share with your neighbors.
Those in the lab understand the magnitude of their mission. They're testing the soil for microbes that could fight germs. If new antibiotics aren't found, the world could return to a time when simple infections were fatal. Merkel comprehends this both on a scientific and personal level. When he was 18 years old, he was diagnosed with leukemia and had a successful bone marrow transplant. After that operation, he relied on antibiotics to fight off infection while his immune system was compromised.
You know, the reality is now, it's not just that you have to go through a serious health crisis. There can be infections that were considered at one time something that was minor that now can ultimately become a crisis for certain individuals. And so we all have a vested interest in this.
A couple of trends brought us to what both Merkel and Handelsman call a public health crisis. In the 1980s, many big pharmaceutical companies stopped making antibiotics in favor of making more lucrative drugs. As the production of new antibiotics decreased, so-called superbugs had the chance to mutate and become resistant. The Small World Initiative hopes to get students and researchers looking for the building blocks to fight infection. The answer could be right under their feet. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, Todd Berry, longtime head of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Association, is retiring, and he's worried about the rise of partisan divisions in Wisconsin politics. He tells us why he says our full-time legislature is a big part of the problem. We'll find out why Janesville will be the home of a unique production facility making an isotope used in the treatment of some kinds of cancer. And we'll take a look at etiquette in the digital age, and we'll find out why it's getting more common to ignore texts and emails and more accepted by some people, but not everyone, when you don't respond to that text or email. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.